taking my pills and washing them down with liquor.
What are you talking about?
I just told you. His eyes met mine with something like comprehension.
When did this start?
He's always helped himself, but it's really ramped up since we got here.
I had no idea.
He stared into space. After what felt like an eternity, he took a deep breath and slapped his thighs.
All right. Don't worry, darling girl. I'll straighten him out.
It's too late, I said.
I'll straighten him out, Hank said firmly.
When the front door clicked shut behind him, I whispered again, It's too late. Ellis returned to the inn that night, sober and courteous to a fault. His calm exterior and placid expression were too calm, too placid, and I wondered whether he was masking terrible hurt or terrible anger. I began to second-guess myself. If he really was colorblind, and I'd accused him of faking it, I was no better than all the other judgmental people. But if he was faking it and knew I'd found out, I was as lethal to him as a loaded gun. If the colonel discovered that Ellis had lied to shirk duty, he'd disown him immediately and permanently, and there would be nothing Edith Stonehide or anybody else could do about it. Either way, I'd made a mistake and was going to have to fix it. When Ellis laid eyes on me the next morning, his expression confirmed how critical it was for me to get things back on an even keel. The second he saw me, his jaw clenched, and he stared at his logbook. I hated what I had to do, and hated even more that I knew how. I would be drawing directly from my mother's playbook. "Good morning, darling," I said, joining him. "Where's Hank?" He made a great show of licking his finger and turning the page. "Sweetheart, please tell me what I've done," I said. "You left in such a hurry yesterday, and then you barely spoke to me at dinner." "I know I've done something, but I don't know what." He continued to look down at the book, pretending I wasn't there. "Except that's not true," I said miserably. "I do know why you're angry. It was my pitiful attempt at a joke, wasn't it? Alice, please look at me." He lifted his face. His expression was glacial, his eyes hard. "My joke about the gloves," I went on. "I was trying to be funny, not make fun of you. But I should have known better than to joke about your condition. It was awful of me." He had no reaction at all. He simply stared, his lips pressed into a grim line. I had no choice but to barrel on, because I had no other plan. "I thought if I told you my gloves were green, you'd think Hank had pulled a prank on you by picking the wrong color case for my gas mask. But then it all went wrong. As soon as I saw your face, I should have stopped. But I was so far in, I kept going and tried to turn it around instead. It's all so stupid. I really do need new gloves, and I was just trying to come up with a clever way of asking. It was the vaudeville in me trying to come out, but I'm no star. I meant to be a supporting act. So rest assured that yesterday's performance marked both the debut and finale of my solo career in practical jokes." He finally spoke.
"Not vaudeville, burlesque."
My cheeks burned. "Yes, of course. It's just we don't usually call it that."
"My mother always said that blood will out. I wish I'd paid attention."
My mouth opened and closed a couple of times before I could respond. "I suppose I deserved that, after what I said to you." He laughed once, a short, harsh bray. The two of them didn't return to the inn that night, or the next, so I had no idea if Ellis had bought my story about the gloves. They left no note or any other indication of where they had gone. Chapter 26. When Anna finally returned, 5 days after learning of Hugh's death, she accepted my condolences and otherwise simply carried on, although there was a heaviness in her step that hadn't been there before. She let me resume doing the rooms, for which I was very grateful, because I'd been losing my mind trying to stay out of Rona's way and had no idea what I'd say to Angus if I found myself alone with him. The crone apparently shared Anna's view about picking up after others, because Alice's dirty socks and underpants lay exactly where he'd stepped out of them 3 nights before, and his pajamas lay in a crumpled heap in the corner. Hank had at least tossed his clothes onto the chair. Of the 100 pills I'd initially found in Ellis's room, only 36 were left. Hank and Ellis returned that night. When they came through the door, I took a deep breath, steeling myself.
"Darling," said Ellis.
He swooped over and kissed my cheek before sitting next to me on the couch. He stank of paraffin oil, but not liquor.
"Did you miss me?" he asked.
"Of course," I said, trying to read his face. Hank plopped down on one of the chairs opposite.
"You'll never guess where we've been." "She doesn't care about that," said Ellis, rubbing his hands together. "Quick, get her Prezi."
Hank dug around in one of the duffel bags and handed Ellis a thin, gift-wrapped box, which he solemnly presented on the palms of both hands. I pulled off the satin bow and lifted the lid. A pair of red kid gloves lay inside, on tissue paper flecked with gold. The blood drained from my face.
"What do you think? Do you like them?" he asked.
"They're beautiful," I said.
"More importantly, what color are they?"
"They are red," I said in a near whisper.
"Good,"
said Alice, smiling broadly.
"That's what Hank said, too, but I never know with you two jokers."
He held a hand over his head and snapped his fingers.
"Bartender, two whiskeys. Actually, just bring the bottle."
Angus glared, but pulled out two glasses. Meg picked them up and tucked a bottle under her arm, her expression conveying every word that didn't come out of her mouth. The gloves were a message, obviously, but what did they mean? Had I managed to convince Ellis that I still believed he was colorblind? Or had he interpreted my desperate soliloquy as a promise to keep his secret? Or was he actually colorblind? Over the course of the evening, Ellis drank almost a whole bottle of whiskey, but he remained, at least outwardly, jovial. He kept a proprietorial hand on my shoulder or leg the entire time, and it was a constant struggle to keep from shrinking away. I stole occasional glances at Angus, whose face was unreadable. I'd been back to the graveyard twice since seeing his scars, and had myself mostly convinced that he was the Angus on the stone, the one who'd lost everything in the space of 6 weeks. I thought often of our embrace by the fire, and wondered if he did, too. They never told me where they'd been, and I didn't ask. Despite Hank's promise to straighten Ellis out, they fell right back into their old pattern of returning to the inn plastered, and then continuing to drink until they were both in a stupor. Judging from his fast diminishing stash, Ellis was also gobbling pills. By my estimation, he was taking anywhere from 8 to 10 a day. On the night I knew he'd run out, he knocked on my door and asked if he could have one. After popping one into his mouth, he shook more into his hand and slid them into his pocket. From what remained, I figured he'd taken about 50, enough to last him 5 or 6 days. We achieved a tenuous kind of normal. Ellis seemed to have completely forgotten about the glove incident, and while he was consistently drunk, he never tipped into a rage. Every day he looked for a letter from his mother, and every day it didn't come. He began to say he didn't need her anyway. He was more certain than ever that when he found the monster, he would clear both his and his father's names, and that the colonel would welcome him back with open arms and checkbook. Finding the monster in Loch Ness was all he cared about. He remained as ignorant as ever about the monster facing the rest of the world. I began to iron the newspaper in the hope that he or Hank might start to read it. They did not. Although there was no question that it was selfish and cowardly to blinker themselves against the chaos and horror, there were times I almost understood. At the end of January, the Red Army had liberated a network of death camps in Auschwitz, Poland, and the details that trickled out over the days and weeks were so excruciating, I fought a very real urge to remain ignorant myself. Hundreds of thousands of people, perhaps many, many more, because the reports were often contradictory, had been interned and killed, most of them simply for being Jewish. They had been rounded up and transported in cattle cars and assigned to either death or hard labor as soon as they climbed out. Death was by gas chamber, and the chambers and crematoriums ran night and day. Many of those spared immediate death died anyway, from illness,
starvation, torture, and exhaustion. There were rumors of a mad doctor and unthinkable experiments. When the SS realized the Red Army was closing in, they tried to destroy the evidence. They blew up the gas chambers and crematoriums and set fire to other buildings before retreating on foot, forcing tens of thousands of starving inmates, every last person who was capable of walking, to march further into Nazi territory toward other death camps. The only people they left behind were those they were certain were dying. They shot people randomly as they retreated. Even the hardened soldiers of the Russian army were unprepared for what they found. 648 corpses that lay where they'd fallen, and more than 7,000 survivors, in such terrible condition they continued to die despite immediate rescue efforts. They discovered that the SS had burned the infirmary with everyone inside it, 239 souls in all. One of the six storage buildings the SS had not had time to destroy was filled with tons, literally tons of women's hair, along with human teeth, the fillings extracted, and tens of thousands of children's outfits. I despaired of humanity. Although the Allies were making progress, I thought maybe it was too late, that evil had already prevailed. Chapter 27. With Anna weighed down by fresh grief and my own days as available as ever, I took it upon myself to expand my household duties, although I kept to the upstairs so I wouldn't get caught. I began sweeping the bedroom carpets with a witch-like broom, which turned out to be made of dried heather, and then, since I was sweeping anyway, did the hallway to the top of the stairs. Less than a week after Anna's return, I was doing the entire upstairs on my own, polishing the doorknobs, trimming and filling the lamps, gathering laundry, changing the sheets, even scouring the sink, tub, and toilet with Vim powder. Meg repaired my manicure as necessary, so while my nails were shorter, they were as flashy as ever, and Ellis remained none the wiser. I grew bolder, and one day decided to sweep all the way down the stairs, since that was where the carpet ended. Too late, I heard the clicking of Connell's toenails, and a moment later was face to face with Angus. I was on the bottom step, in an apron, clutching the broom. I froze like a deer in the middle of the road. A sudden widening of his eyes betrayed his surprise. "Good afternoon," I said, after a few beats of silence, trying to act as though we found ourselves in this situation all the time. He frowned.
"And how long has this been going on?"
"A while," I said, feeling the heat rise to my cheeks. "Please don't blame Anna. It was entirely my idea. I just wanted to help." The corners of his mouth twitched, and a twinkle crept into his eyes. He laughed before continuing on his way, shaking his head, and followed by a visibly confused Connell. I sank down on a stair, lightheaded with relief. I had been restricting my efforts to the upstairs, only for fear of getting caught, but since Angus apparently didn't mind, I began to help in the kitchen as well. I always brought my coat, gloves, and gas mask with me, so that if Ellis and Hank returned early, I could slip out the back and return by the front, pretending I'd been on a walk. This was Meg's idea, and Anna objected vehemently. She was adamant that it was bad luck for a person to enter and leave a house by different doors. Although I was close to useless to begin with, I was a willing student, and they were patient with me. I soon learned how to scrape, not peel, carrots and potatoes, and how to cube turnips. After my first brackish mishap, I learned how to properly salt water for boiling, and not just how to slice bread, but how to do it to wartime standards. Vendors weren't allowed to sell bread of any kind, even national loaf, until it was stale enough to be sliced thinly. Anna confessed her suspicion that national loaf was not made of flour at all, but rather ground-up animal feed, and I thought she was probably right. It would explain a lot about the dense, mealy bread that was commonly referred to as Hitler's secret weapon. It was rumored to be an aphrodisiac, a rumor many suspected had been started by the government itself to get people to eat it. I learned that all tea was loose leaf and steeped more than once, and also that the strength of a guest's tea was directly related to Anna's feelings about the person. At that point, Hank and Ellis were drinking hot water with a splash of milk.
I discovered that in addition to Anna's many personal beliefs, she couldn't see a crow through the window without running outside to see how many there were, and then analyzing what the number meant. There were all kinds of universally accepted sources of bad luck. One of them explained why I hadn't been able to find any meat the day Anna thought I'd seen the König and run off before starting dinner. It was considered unlucky to store it inside, and so it was kept in a ventilated meat safe out back. I also discovered that Angus was responsible for the contents of many a meat safe. In the hill, just beyond the Anderson shelter, was a tall, drafty dugout, which he kept stocked with venison, grouse, pheasant, and other game, hanging it until it was tender. Anna and Meg took what was necessary for the inn and wrapped the remainder in newspaper, which Angus then left on the doorsteps of families in need, delivering the packets at night so no one would feel beholden. I'd already figured out that Angus was poaching. How else to explain the visit from Bob the Bobby, or the ample supply of game? But I wasn't shocked, as I once might have been. My education at the hands of Anna and Meg included enough history that I understood the policeman's reluctance to enforce the law, and also that it reflected the prevailing attitude. It started the day I asked Anna what made a croft, instead of just a farm, and got an unexpected earful.
"It is a farm," she said indignantly, "only not quite big enough to support a family. That's the definition of a croft."
Meg shot me a glance that said, "Well, now you've done it," and she was right. Although the events Anna spoke of had taken place nearly 200 years before, she railed on with as much outrage as if they'd occurred the previous week. She said that in 1746, following the Battle of Culloden, the final brutal confrontation in the Jacobite Rising, the Loyalists forced an end to the clan system so the Jacobites could never rise again. They seized their traditional lands and dispersed clan members, banishing individual families onto tiny tracts and expecting them to become farmers overnight. The former communal hunting grounds were turned into sheep farms and sporting estates, and anyone caught hunting on them was subject to severe penalties. The aristocratic shooting party's right to an undepleted stock was held to be more important than feeding the starving. But it didn't end there. Beyond the physical displacement and the abrupt, forced end of the clan system was a methodical attempt to wipe out the culture. Speaking Gaelic became a crime, and the first sons of clan chiefs were forced to attend British public schools, returning with the same upper-class accent my father-in-law had affected during the heady days of his celebrity. I imagined the colonel strutting around in his estate tweeds with a smug sense of superiority on full display, and realized that the loathing Rona and old Donnie felt for him, and all of us by association, ran far deeper than anything he'd done personally.
"And that's why the taking of a deer is a righteous theft," Anna said, wrapping up with a decisive nod.
She had unknowingly repeated Meg's words from the day she showed me the Anderson shelter, and I finally understood. The taking of a deer was a righteous theft because it was taken from land that was stolen. Because of their overlapping shifts, I spent the first part of each day with just Anna and the latter part with just Meg, and during these times, our chit-chat sometimes turned to confidences. From Meg, I learned that Anna's brother, Hugh, had stepped on a mine, and what could be found of his remains had been buried in Holland. The other brother she'd lost, 21-year-old Hector, had been hit in the chest by a mortar bomb during the D-Day landings. His body was never recovered, although a fellow soldier had paused long enough to grab his identification tags. From Anna, I learned that Meg had lost her entire family, both parents and 2 younger sisters, 4 years earlier in the Clydebank Blitz. 528 people were killed, 617 injured, and 35,000 left homeless during 2 nights of relentless air raids that left a mere 7 out of 12,000 houses intact. Meg had been spared only because she'd already joined the forestry corps and was in Drumna Drocket. I kept hoping one of them would offer some information about Angus's background, enough to confirm or refute my theory about the gravestone, but they didn't, and I couldn't ask for fear of giving myself away. I was fully aware that my desire to know wasn't based on curiosity alone. Chapter 28. Meg told us the young women at the forestry corps were so excited about the upcoming Valentine's Day dance that they had been reprimanded twice for their lack of concentration around the huge engine-driven saws. I couldn't blame them. Several of the girls, including Meg, expected to be presented with rings, making their engagements official. As the day grew closer, the lumberjack's remarks became increasingly ribald. The night before the dance, one of them said something so off-color, it turned Meg into a red-headed fury. She leaned over Rory, who flattened himself against his chair and scolded him harshly, even as he protested, correctly, that he hadn't said a thing.
"But you did nothing to stop him, did you?" she said,
still holding a finger in front of his face. He glowered at her, but his arms hung slack off the sides of his chair. When she spun and flounced off, her red curls bouncing, the older men at the bar gave somber nods of approval, and the rest of the lumberjacks, who understood that Rory had been reprimanded for all of them, went on their best behavior. Hank leaned in toward Ellis and held a hand up to the side of his mouth so his voice wouldn't carry.
"Who's the tough guy now?" he snickered.
Ellis was too distracted to be amused. Not 20 minutes before, he'd excused himself and gone upstairs, only to return looking pale. I knew exactly what had happened. He'd tried my door and found it locked. When I did the rooms that morning, I'd noticed he was down to 5 pills. I knew he must be desperate to get more, and wondered why he didn't just come out and ask me, like he always did. Maybe he didn't want to ask in front of Hank. I didn't know. But whatever the reason, I was grateful, because I couldn't have helped him anyway. I'd flushed the rest of the pills down the toilet. On the day of the dance, Meg, Anna, and I went to special effort to dress up the front room, because we knew girls would be coming in. We put linens on the tables, and Anna created something called coley flowers. She blamed the lack of real flowers on both weather and the war, and instead put 4 or 5 pieces of coal in glass bowls, added water, salt, and ammonia, before finally pouring a mixture of violet and blue ink over them. It was a complete mystery to me how this alchemy would result in anything resembling flowers, but they were blooming within the hour. We didn't have enough to put on each table, so we decided that Meg would herd the girls toward the tables that had them, and steer the men, who wouldn't appreciate them anyway, elsewhere. The job was Meg's by default, because Anna would have gone home by then, and I, of course, would be waiting by the fire for Ellis and Hank. The coley flowers were not our only efforts. Among the three of us, we'd managed to come up with enough eggs and sugar to make 2 glazed bundt cakes, which were resting in the dead center of the wooden table, in an attempt to keep them out of Connell's reach. The beast himself was sprawled across his master's bed, watching keenly. He was tall enough to reach anything he liked if we turned our backs, but there was no chance of that. We would have protected those cakes with our lives. Meg and I had given up our egg and sugar rations for the week, which were enough to make 1 cake, but then Anna's hens went on a laying spree. Because they lived on a croft, the Mackenzies got chicken feed instead of egg rations, so their supply was sometimes iffy, but on this occasion, the hens came through like champs. Each of the dance-goers was going to get a proper slice instead of just a taste. As Anna prepared to leave hours later than usual, her mood deflated. "I don't remember the last time I had cake," she said, looking longingly at them.
"Don't you worry," said Meg. "We'll put aside the very first slice, and it will be lovely and thick, too."
"Thank you," Anna said, still sounding glum.
"I suppose I'll be off, then. Have a grand time. And mind you, I want to hear all the details tomorrow."
Anna's parents were staunch weefries, and she wasn't even allowed to wear face powder, never mind attend a dance. Music itself was not allowed, except on Sundays, and then it had to be for the sake of worship only, and sung unadorned. The senior Mackenzies were so strict, they confined their cockerel under a bushel basket on the Sabbath, so he wouldn't get up to anything untoward with the hens. I understood Anna's melancholy because I also wished I could go to the dance, although that would require an alternate universe in which Ellis didn't exist. At least I'd be able to witness the prelude. I was particularly looking forward to seeing the reaction to the cakes, since I'd had a hand in making them. Although I'd only cracked the eggs and stirred the batter,
I'd never been as proud of anything in my life. Because we didn't trust Connell with the cakes, I stayed in the kitchen to guard them while Meg went upstairs to get ready. She returned looking like a Valentine's Day dream, in a figure-hugging dress printed with tiny red hearts, her hair carefully arranged, and lips painted into a vermilion cupid's bow. Her high-heeled shoes were made of red suede, with pretty lace-up fronts. They had to be brand new. I couldn't imagine suede surviving a single day in that climate. I also noticed she was wearing stockings, and a smile crept across my face. She followed my gaze, blushed, and smiled back.
"What do you think?"
"I think Rory will be knocked off his feet," I said. "I think you'll be the belle of the ball."
"Well, at least I won't have to worry about so-and-so over there trying to lick the gravy browning off my legs."
Connell's tail slid back and forth. It was my turn to get dressed for dinner, but I hesitated. I knew I wouldn't have another chance to talk to her alone, and I wanted to say something about her imminent proposal. I found myself tongue-tied, probably because I was distinctly unqualified to offer advice in the marriage department. Eventually, Meg saved me.
"Now go on," she scolded, flicking her fingers toward the door. "Make yourself up properly. Tonight, more than ever, beauty is your duty. Even if it's wasted on your pair of boring McBorringtons over by the fire, the others will notice. And your dress had better be fancy. And it had better be red, especially tonight. Remember, red is a new badge of..."
I know," I said, cutting her off with a laugh. "I'll wear red, and good luck tonight. Not that you'll need it." I sprinted off before she could reply. I made up my face as though I really were going to a party and chose a red taffeta poodle dress that didn't look expensive because it wasn't. I bought it myself off the rack before Ellis took control of my wardrobe. Finally, I used an eye pencil to draw a shaky line up the back of each leg. I wanted to fit in, not stick out, and that night especially, I didn't want to steal anyone's thunder. By the time Ellis and Hank came through the front door, their cheeks flushed with the elements and whatever else, the other side of the room was filling up.
"Well, would you look at that," said Hank, coming to a halt.
The mood was electrifying. The girls, all impeccably groomed, were admiring the cakes, which had been presented but not cut. The lumberjacks also made noises about the cakes, but were really admiring the girls. I couldn't help wondering which ones were expecting rings. Meg was standing next to a table of girls from the forestry corps. She leaned over to point out how the cauliflower had transformed since Anna conjured it into being, but I knew exactly what she was really doing. It took but a moment.
"Wait, those are real seams," squealed one of the other girls. "How on earth did you get your hands on stockings?"
The lumberjacks murmured surprise, as though they weren't already looking at Meg's legs. Having been given an excuse, they stared openly, hungrily.
"Oh," Meg said, shrugging coyly. "They magically appeared."
She turned her ankle to better display the back of her calf. Hank and Ellis watched all this from just inside the door. Finally, Hank dug an elbow into Ellis, and they launched themselves toward the fire. Ellis tripped on the edge of the rug and fell forward, catching himself on the back of a chair. He navigated his way around it, clutching it all the while, and dropped onto its seat. His eyes were bloodshot, his forehead was shiny, and I was shot through with dread. Hank was so busy looking at Meg that he planted himself squarely on the arm of the second chair before tumbling sideways into it, leaving his head hanging over one upholstered arm and his legs dangling off the other. After a few seconds of stunned surprise, he hauled himself upright. Ellis looked me up and down. His eyes narrowed, his lip curled in disgust.
"What's this?"
I knew he meant my cheap dress and lack of stockings, but I feigned ignorance. "They're going to a dance," I said. "It's Valentine's Day."
"It's what?" said Hank. "Oh, shit. I should have sent something to Violet." "No, I meant this get-up," said Ellis, waving the back of his hand toward me. "It's like a combination of scullery maid and streetwalker."
I clamped my mouth shut. There was no point in explaining why I was dressed the way I was.
There was no point in doing anything at all, except keeping quiet and hoping the moment would pass.
"Well, I think she's a sight for sore eyes," said Hank, still fixated on Meg. "If I'd known she'd be so excited about a pair of stockings, I would have given her a dozen. I'd have given her as many as she wanted. In fact, there's no telling what I might give that girl. With that face and figure, she could come up in the world, like Maddie's mother."
He swung his head briefly toward me.
"No offense, darling girl." "Don't take up with trash, Hank," said Alice, still staring at me. "Blood will out. It always does."
"What?" Hank asked vaguely. He was back to gazing at Meg's calves.
"You can't make a silk purse, is what?" said Alice.
"No, those are definitely silk.
Look at those gams. I bet they're a mile long. They deserve nothing less than the finest silk."
"Hank," I said desperately. I waved, trying to get his attention. "Hank!" He glanced quickly and said,
"You look nice too, Maddie. Definitely a silk purse." "So, Maddie, this silk purse of yours," Alice said with deadly purpose, "is it red or is it green?"
Adrenaline blasted from my core to my extremities. "I beg your pardon," I said.
"It is red or is it green?"
"It's a fine brocade, a veritable smorgasbord of color," said Hank, still completely oblivious to the parallel conversation.
"Maddie, you didn't answer me," said Alice.
The corner of his right eye began to twitch. "I can't," I said, looking into my lap.
"And why's that?"
"Because you were right."
"About what?"
"About everything."
"Say it."
"Fine. There's no silk purse. There's only a sow's ear." He gave a bitter laugh.
"Submission is a color that suits you, my dear. You should wear it more often."
"I suppose you would know," I said, before turning toward the bar. Meg was serving slices of cake to an admiring audience. Rory had still not arrived, and while she was putting on a brave face, I could tell she was wilting.
"I'd have some of her cake. Oh, yes, indeed," Hank said with a low whistle.
He swiveled suddenly in his seat.
"Say, kids, I just had a crazy idea. Let's go to the dance. It'll be like the servants' ball at Christmas. You two lovebirds can do your own thing, and I, well, I might just find a pretty little lovebird of my own, to tide me over, so to speak."
He beamed expectantly at us. When neither of us answered, his smile fell away. His eyes darted suspiciously between us.
"Oh, come on,"
he groaned, before glancing at the ceiling in despair.
"Are you two at it again? Let me guess. Ella said something totally stupid, and now you're not talking to him. Hell, you're not even looking at him. Is this what marriage does to people? No wonder I want nothing to do with it. Neither one of you is an ounce of fun anymore."
He sighed and turned back toward the bar.
"Now that one over there, she looks like an ounce or two of fun."
Chapter 29 At 8 on the nose, twin brothers from Halifax dropped to their knees and presented matching engagement rings to their sweethearts. When the blushing girls said yes, the remaining lumberjacks burst into song, serenading the brides-to-be with "O Canada." No sooner had they started than old Ian McIntosh nipped across the road and returned with his pipes, striking in and accompanying the young men as they followed up with a heartfelt rendition of "Farewell to Nova Scotia." Ellis sipped his whiskey steadily and continued to stare at me like he wanted me dead. Halfway through a ballad of New Scotland, I could stand it no longer and rushed upstairs, locking myself in my room. I leaned against the door, panting. Not 2 minutes later, with the pipes still blaring on the main floor, I thought I heard something and pressed my ear to the door. Ellis was swearing and stumbling in the hallway, and sure enough came straight to my room. When he found the door locked, he began to pound it.
"Maddie! Maddie! Open the goddamned door!"
"Go away!" I dove onto the bed, pulling my knees to my chest.
"Open the goddamned door! I'm fucking serious!"
I knew he was using the side of his fist because of the way the door jumped in its frame. I wished I could light a candle so I could see if it was in danger of giving, but my hands were shaking too hard to strike a match.
"Maddie! If you don't open the goddamned door right now, I swear to fucking God I'll break it down. Do you hear me?"
he roared, renewing his assault. I curled into a ball and pressed my hands to my ears. I couldn't scream for help. There was no possibility anyone would hear me over the booming of the pipes. But where the hell was Hank? Surely he'd noticed we'd both disappeared, and surely he'd been at least vaguely aware of the state Ellis was in. Over a period that felt like centuries, the thumping slowed to an uneven staccato, and finally stopped altogether. I heard a soft clunk as Ellis slumped against my door. He began to weep.
"Maddie! Oh, Maddie, what have you done? You're my wife. You're supposed to be on my team. Now what am I supposed to do? What the hell am I supposed to do?"
His fingernails scraped against the wood as he slid to the floor. He continued crying, but that, too, eventually petered out. A few minutes later, all I could hear was my own ragged breath. Just as I began to believe he was out for the night, I heard shuffling on the carpet, then a pause. I held my breath. A terrible primal scream preceded a massive blow to the door, followed by another, and then another, as he repeatedly rammed it with his body. When the wood started to crack, I scrambled off the bed, fumbling in the dark, until I found the grate and the fire irons. Then I crouched behind the chair, clutching the poker and crying. There was another tremendous blow to the door, and the clatter and thud of a body falling, followed by copious swearing. Then I heard Hank.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?" "I need to talk to my wife."
"Get up, you moron," Hank said calmly.
"I need to talk to my..."
Ellis huffed and puffed, but could not seem to come up with a final word.
"You can't even stand up. Let's get you to bed." "I need to talk to her," Ellis insisted,
although he sounded suddenly out of steam. He moaned, then began sobbing again. I crept over to the door, still clutching the fire iron.
"Good Lord," said Hank. "You're a complete mess. Give me your hand."
Ellis mumbled something incoherent.
"No, you didn't dislocate your shoulder. If you had, I wouldn't be able to do this."
There was a sharp holler of pain, followed by whimpering.
"See? But if you had dislocated it, you'd have fucking well earned it for being a knucklehead. Give me your hand." "All right, upsy-daisy. Now give me your key and don't move."
There was a crash against the wall right outside my door.
"Jesus, can you at least try not to fall over while I get your door open? Do you think you could handle that?"
Ellis was drawing heavy, wheezing breaths, so close it sounded like he was in the room with me. The door to his bedroom opened, and Hank came back.
"All right, one foot in front of the other."
After a few seconds of clunking and shuffling, I heard the violent screech of bedsprings. It sounded like Hank had tossed Ellis into his room from the doorway.
"Stay put," said Hank. "If you don't, I swear to God I'll tie you to the bed."
The door shut, and a moment later there were three polite raps on my door.
"Maddie," said Hank.
"Yes," I said, still crouched with the fire iron.
"Are you sitting by the door?"
"Yes."
"Are you okay?"
I didn't answer. My heart was thumping so hard, I was sure he could hear it, and I was shaking uncontrollably. After a pause, he said,
"Okay, I get it. You're mad at me, but what was I supposed to do? Knock the bottle from his hand?"
"Yes." He sighed, and I heard him scratch his head.
"Yeah, you're right. This won't happen again, I swear. By the way, I locked him in. Want the key?"
"No, you can have it."
"Get some sleep," he said. "He won't be bothering you again tonight. And, Maddie, I really am sorry."
He waited a while before going away, hoping, I suppose, that I'd tell him it was okay. But I couldn't. Things weren't even remotely okay, and with Ellis out of pills, they could only get worse. Why, oh why, had I flushed them? When Ian McIntosh's pipes finally stopped, the gathering downstairs exploded with applause. They cheered, whooped, and stamped their feet until the whole building shook. Within minutes, the younger crowd had gathered in the street and gone on to the public hall, but even after they left, the men who remained at the bar, the older men, the locals, spoke and laughed and raised voices, excited by their participation in the impromptu Kaylee. I made my way to the window, still in the dark,
pulled out the blackout frame and opened the sash. I heard accordion and fiddle music coming from the public hall, along with laughing, singing, and animated conversations, including a few that sounded like arguments. Despite the icy air, I knelt by the window and rested my head on the sill, listening. I felt a terrible pang of longing. Less than half a mile away, young people, people my age, people in love, were planning futures together, futures that would include all the perks of truly loving each other, intimacy, passion, children, companionship, even though there were sure to be trials along the way. Some of the couples might even end up mismatched and miserable, but at that particular moment, they were as happy and joyful as the rest, and no matter how mismatched or miserable they turned out to be, I could almost guarantee that none of them would end up with a marriage like mine. Footsteps came up the road, and I heard a man and a woman talking. They stopped at the house opposite the inn and went silent for what I could only assume was a goodnight kiss. He whispered something, and she went inside, giggling. He waited a few seconds after the door closed, and then whistled as he headed back down the road. Eventually, I replaced the blackout frame and went to bed.
"You liar! You whore!"
A man's angry shouting jolted me awake, and I initially thought Ellis was back. Then I heard Meg crying and realized the man was Rory. They were in the hallway. I jumped out of bed and lit the candle on my dresser. Then I stood with my ear to the door.
"I swear by everything that's holy, I'm telling you the truth."
There was a smack, followed by Meg's sharp cry. I grabbed the fire iron, which was still leaning by the door.
"You worthless lying slut! Tell me who he is! Tell me!"
"There is no one else," she pleaded.
"Then why can't you tell me where you got the stockings?"
"I did tell you, Rory."
"You want me to believe they just magically appeared? What kind of a fool?"
Another smack, another cry.
"Do you take me for? What else has he given you, or did you earn them? Is that it? Have you turned professional? What's your price, then? What does a pair of stockings buy a man?"
"Rory, for the love of God."
"Is it that flat-footed bastard? I've seen how he looks at you. What room is he in? Tell me, tell me!"
When Meg screamed, I yanked my door open and rushed out. The only light was coming from the candle behind me, but it was enough for me to see him haul back and punch her in the side of the face. She dropped to her knees, clutching her cheek, sobbing. She was completely naked. He was in an open shirt and underpants.
"Stop!" I cried. "She's telling the truth!"
He glanced over his shoulder. Our eyes locked. He turned deliberately back to Meg, grabbed a handful of her hair, and kicked her full force in the ribs. The sound of the blow was a terrible, muted thud. She made an oof noise as the air was forced out of her.
"I gave them to her!"
I shrieked. He kicked her again, still holding her by the hair, then tossed her aside. She collapsed and made no effort to move, like an unclothed porcelain doll dropped in a nursery. As he pulled his leg back to deliver another kick, I raised the poker and tore down the hallway. Before I could get there, Angus charged out of the stairwell and in a single motion had Rory pinned against the wall by his throat, dangling him so his feet were above the ground. Rory's hands swatted at and finally grabbed the hand around his throat, but he didn't make a sound. Angus's other arm remained at his side, his fingers splayed.
"What the fuck is going on?"
said Hank, peeking out of his room with a candle. When he saw, he ducked back in. I dropped the poker and rushed to Meg. She was conscious, but barely. I dragged her toward her room and crouched beside her, wrapping my arms around her, shielding her nakedness. She whimpered and covered her head with her arms. There was a rhythmic thumping across the hall. I looked up, expecting to see Angus throwing punches. Instead, he continued to dangle Rory with one hand. The thumping was Rory, slapping the wall behind him with open palms. His eyes bulged and his tongue protruded, and while the light was faint, his face was clearly not the right color and getting darker quickly. The slapping got slower and finally ceased. A wet patch appeared on the front of his underpants, and urine trickled down his leg, over his foot, and onto the floor. It felt like an eternity, but it was probably only a few seconds later that Angus dropped him. He crumpled to the floor, and remained utterly still. I was sure he was dead, but after a few seconds he jerked violently and clutched his throat, gasping for air. It was a terrible sound, grating and rasping. Angus stood beside Rory, hands on hips. He was in blue-striped pajama bottoms, but no shirt. Not a one of us was properly covered, least of all Meg, and it made the horror of the moment somehow more real. Angus poked Rory with his foot.
"I don't suppose I need to tell you what will happen if I ever find you darkening my door again," he said.
Rory writhed on the floor, drawing ragged, scratchy breaths and still grasping his throat.
"I'll take that as a no," said Angus,
leaning over and lifting Rory by the armpits. He turned and threw him into the stairwell. I held my breath during the series of bangs and thuds as Rory fell down the stairs. I was sure I'd just witnessed a murder, but moments later I heard the front door open and then click quietly shut. Chapter 30 Angus scooped Meg out of my arms as though she weighed nothing.
"Pull back the bedclothes," he ordered, sending me scrambling across the floor. "And you," he said to Hank, who'd appeared in the doorway with a candle. "Bring that in and light the others."
Angus laid Meg on the bed and drew the covers over her pale, naked form. She rolled onto her right side, crying quietly. Her left cheek was bloodied, her eyelid ballooning. Blood trickled from her nose, and her lip was split.
"Where else did he hurt you, maiden?"
Angus said softly, sitting on the edge of the bed. He stroked the top of her head as though she were a child. She just wept.
"He kicked her in the ribs," I said. "Hard."
Angus swung his head around.
"And what were you doing out there? You could have been hurt as well."
"I was going to kill him."
He stared at me for several seconds.
"I'm going to get Dr. McLean," he said, standing up. "There's a first aid kit in the kitchen. It's tucked in behind the..."
"I know where it is," I said. "I'll get it." Angus nodded and turned to Hank, who had by then lit the other candles.
"You, fetch some logs from the peat stock downstairs and get a fire going in here. And light the hall lamps. It's going to be a long night."
I ran down the stairs, feeling my way in the dark to where I knew there was a flashlight. I located the white metal tin with the red cross and knocked down the soap flakes in my haste to grab it. As I sprinted back upstairs, I passed Hank on his way down. I sat on Meg's bed, flipped open the lid, and soaked some cotton wool with iodine. "Oh, Meg, I'm so sorry. This is going to sting," I said, before dabbing the gash on her cheek. She didn't so much as flinch. Her left eye had shut completely in my short absence. The flesh above the socket had expanded and rolled over, creating a grotesque new lid. A trickle of blood ran from the corner of her mouth to the pillow, and with a fresh wave of horror, I wondered if she'd lost any teeth. Hank returned with an armful of logs.
"I have to get some compresses," I said. "She's swelling badly."
I got two large metal bowls from the kitchen and took them out back, leaving the door wide open. I fell to my knees on the frozen ground and scooped up snow, throwing it into one of the bowls and punching it down until ice crystals formed and tore at my knuckles. When I couldn't pack it any harder, I ran back inside, pausing just long enough to kick the door shut with my bare foot. I paused at the sink to fill the second bowl with water, set it on top of the first, and dropped a pile of clean rags into it. When I appeared in the doorway with the stacked bowls, Hank turned his head, but otherwise didn't move. He'd managed to get a small fire going and stood awkwardly in front of it.
"Hank, the hall lamps," I said.
He sprang into action. I set the bowls on the bedside table, wrung out a cloth, and draped it across Meg's forehead. I folded another and laid it on her cheek, right under her eye. Then I sat beside her, stroking her tangled hair and making shushing noises until I realized my fingers were sticky with blood. When I investigated, I found that a chunk of her hair was missing, leaving a patch of bright red scalp exposed. I cleaned that as well, before covering it with yet another cold cloth. Meg didn't react to any of it. As I waited for Angus to return with the doctor, there was nothing I could do but sit with her, swapping out the compresses when they were no longer cold, and watching the water turn pink. I'd never felt so helpless in all my life. Dr. McLean banished everyone while he examined Meg, so the rest of us went downstairs to wait. As far as I could tell, Ellis had slept through the entire thing. That, or he was dead, but I saw no reason to check. If he was dead, he'd still be dead in the morning. Hank and I sat by the dampened fire. Angus lit a lamp and paced. He'd pulled on a sweater before heading out into the night, but I knew Hank had already seen his scars. They were impossible to miss. When Dr. McLean finally emerged from the stairwell, I leapt to my feet. "How is she?" The doctor set his bag on the floor and adjusted his glasses.
"I've given her morphine, so for the moment she's comfortable, but she's taken a very serious beating. Do you happen to know the brute responsible?"
"Aye,"
said Angus.
"And he's taken a wee beating himself."
"Will she be all right?" I asked.
"She has a concussion, a great number of contusions, bruising of the spleen and kidney, and at least 3 cracked ribs. She lost the top molars on the left side, and the bicuspids are loose, although they might take hold again."
"We need to call an ambulance," I said. "Surely she needs to go to the hospital."
"Ordinarily, I'd agree," said Dr. McLean. "But under the circumstances, if there's any possibility she can be cared for here, I think that would be preferable."
"What circumstances?" asked Angus.
"The hospital is in Inverness," the doctor explained, "which is suffering from a fuel shortage and an outbreak of respiratory illness. Chest congestion is the last thing the poor girl needs, with cracked ribs, so I'd strongly prefer not to expose her. But if you do keep her here, you'll need to watch her very closely."
"What do we do?" I asked. After a pause, I realized everyone was staring at me. I turned to Angus. "I know you're busy elsewhere during the day, but between Anna and me, I'm sure we can manage. Maybe Rona can come back for a while."
"Maddie," Hank said slowly, "are you sure you know what you're doing?"
"I know exactly what I'm doing. Angus..." It was the first time I'd addressed him by his Christian name in front of anyone else. He looked hard into my eyes.
"Maddie," Hank said in the background.
"Please," I said to Angus. "The doctor said she'd be better off here, and I'll hold up my end. I promise." He turned to Dr. McLean and nodded.
"She'll stay here."
Hank sat quietly as the doctor gave instructions for Meg's care. We were to watch for signs of shock, paleness, a drop in temperature, a weak or rapid heartbeat. If that happened, we were to call an ambulance immediately because it meant she was bleeding internally. Also, because of the concussion, we were to wake her once an hour for the next 12 hours to check her mental acuity.
"I would normally have you compare her pupils at the same time, but I'm afraid that won't be possible with the swelling. However, each time you wake her, she must take 5 or 6 deep breaths to ward off pneumonia. If she can manage to cough, all the better. She'll not want to, but it's critical. I left morphine on the dresser. With your experience in the field, I assume you're comfortable administering it."
"Aye,"
Angus said grimly.
"Good. Well, unless you have any other questions, I'll be off."
He picked up his bag and went to the door. Angus walked with him.
"And the animal who did this, you say he's been dealt with?"
"For the time being,"
said Angus.
"But if you should happen to be called out to one of the lumberjack camps tonight, may I recommend you take your time, or perhaps even a wrong turn?"
"Aye," the doctor said.
"With the blackout, it can be very difficult to find your way in the dark. One might even say impossible on a night such as this. I assume you'll be paying a visit to the commanding officer tomorrow."
"That I will,"
said Angus.
"And I may well pay a visit to the man himself."
The doctor nodded.
"Under the circumstances, I can't think of a single reason to try to dissuade you. Good evening, Captain Grant."
Hank looked up sharply, and my heart began to pound. I was right. It was him. He was the Angus on the stone. Chapter 31. Although my heart was racing from learning the truth, the rest of me was bone-weary. We all were, and slogged back upstairs in single file. I followed Angus, Connell followed me, and Hank brought up the rear. I stopped cold when I saw Meg. I hadn't thought she could look any worse. "Dear God," I said, creeping closer to the bed. The doctor had stitched up the cut on her lip as well as the gash that ran vertically down her cheek. The latter was terrible to behold, a makeshift black zipper encrusted with blood and indisputable proof that she'd be permanently scarred. I wondered if the missing teeth would hollow out her face, and hoped to God she wouldn't lose the others. Despite all this, she appeared to be in a deep sleep. Hank cleared his throat. He lingered in the hallway, just beyond Meg's door.
"So, do you need me to grab more logs? Or..."
What he was really asking was if he could go to bed, and I hated him for it.
"We'll manage," said Angus.
Hank hung around a few seconds longer before disappearing. I could only imagine what he'd tell Ellis in the morning, but there was nothing I could do about it. When Angus went to get more ice, I retrieved a quilt from my own room, pushed the chair around so it faced Meg, then settled into it, tucking my feet beneath me.
"You should go to bed," Angus said when he came back. "I'll sit with her tonight, and Anna can take over in the morning."
"I'd like to stay, if you don't mind."
"I don't mind, but unless I manage a wee bit of rearranging, you'll probably be on your own in the afternoon."
"That's all right." He stoked the fire, then crouched against the wall. I snuck a quick peek. He was studying me.
"So you were going to kill him, were you?" he asked.
"I meant to, yes." He gave a soft laugh.
"You surprise me, Mrs. Hyde."
"Maddie. I'm just Maddie. Anna and Meg have been calling me that for weeks, except when my husband is around." He looked at me for a very long time, and I wondered how much she had figured out.
"I'm afraid it's time,"
he said 40 minutes later. Meg was difficult to rouse, but we finally managed it by calling her name and tapping the backs of her hands. Angus asked if she knew the date. She replied that it was Valentine's Day and began to cry. "It was her fault," she mumbled through broken lips. "Rory had been in his cups, and she should have known better than to be coy about the stockings, never mind scolding him the night before. He was a good man. Really he was. She was moving to Nova Scotia with him after the war. She'd seen the Welcome to Canada film just the week before, along with all the other girls who were going to marry lumberjacks when the war ended."
"Hush now, maiden," said Angus.
"What if he doesn't come back?"
Angus and I exchanged glances.
"You've got to take some deep breaths now," Angus said. "Only 5, but they must be deep."
"I can't," she wept. "You don't understand. It hurts."
"You've got to, Meg," I said. "It's doctor's orders. You don't want pneumonia, do you?" Angus and I helped her roll onto her back and held her hands, counting aloud as she valiantly filled and emptied her lungs. Her cries were heart-wrenching, but as soon as we counted to 5, she turned onto her side and drifted off.
"Thank God for morphine," Angus said. "She probably won't even remember we woke her."
"How long before her next dose?"
"Not quite 4 hours. I'll give it to her just a wee bit early to stay ahead of the pain. It's better than trying to catch up to it."
As he sat back down, I wondered if he was speaking from personal experience. "What will happen to Rory?" I asked.
"There's no saying, but I can tell you this. He'll never lay a finger on her again."
The fire danced in his brilliant blue eyes, and I knew Meg would be safe from Rory forever, even if she didn't want to be. With everything else that had gone on that night, it was hard to believe that Ellis was still locked in his room, quite possibly tied to the bed. I wanted to crawl across the floor to Angus and tell him everything. I wanted to ask him about his own family. I wanted to feel his arms around me and to wrap mine around him. I wanted to feel the blood coursing through his veins as he vowed to protect me, because I would believe him. Just after we woke Meg for the 3rd time, we heard Anna moving about downstairs. Angus climbed to his feet.
"Well, I suppose I'd better let her know what's happened. Then I have to step out for a while. I have a wee bit of business to take care of."
A few minutes later, Anna raced up the stairs and into the room. When her eyes landed on Meg, she burst into tears. I rushed around the bed to hug her.
"It's evil, Maddie, that's what it is," she said, crying into my shoulder. "Pure evil. What kind of a monster would do such a thing? To our poor, sweet Meg of all people. Meg, who has no kin at all."
"I don't know," I said helplessly.
I really don't know.
When Anna calmed down enough,